Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Farron Cousins, sitting in for Sam Cedar this week. We've got an amazing show coming up today. Ben Dixon's going to be joining me to discuss the vitriol on Twitter and how we need to save our energy for the real battles ahead of us. Luke Savage from Jacobin will be here to tell us how to help motivate non-voters. Congressional candidate Lauren Ashcraft will discuss her campaign to unseat Democratic incumbent Carolyn Maloney in New York's 12th District. And Mike Figueredo, host of The Humanist Report, he's going to tell us how YouTube is hurting progressive channels, and he'll also give us his take on the Democratic field of candidates. And don't forget, you can always get fresh content from Ring of Fire on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. And you can become a member of our YouTube community to gain access to exclusive content. Also, follow the show on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. And you can follow me on Twitter at Farron Balanced. If you spend any time on Twitter, you understand that not only is Twitter an absolutely wonderful resource for news and opinions and all kinds of things, but it is also an absolute hellscape. Twitter can be both, and it is both. You see a lot of fighting. You see a lot of agreements. You see new friends. You make new enemies, all kinds of things. I have Ben Dixon with me right now, the host of the Benjamin Dixon Show. And Ben, you've been talking a lot recently on Twitter, pointing out some of the, I guess you could just call it ridiculousness, because we still have two sides that almost want to relitigate 2016 every day. I mean, this is kind of crazy, isn't it, at this point?
Yeah, I mean, listen, no one was more entrenched in the 2016 battle than me. I mean, that's when I came onto the scene. But honestly, it's an entirely different world right now. 2020 is entirely different than 2016. And what we're facing, particularly with Donald Trump in the White House and this renaissance of fascism is what I'm calling it, we can't afford to relitigate 2020 over and over again to the point where no one from Camp A is going to be able to support anyone from Camp B if they didn't win the primaries. That's what we have to avoid.
Yeah, and we do see a lot of that. I mean, you know, you see it in comments. You know, I'll never vote for X, Y, or Z. I'm only voting for this person. And it does go both ways. I've seen plenty of Bernie people who say that. I've seen Kamala people who say it. I've seen Buttigieg people who say this. So you can't obviously pin this on just one side.
Absolutely.
And I think a lot of people do try to do that because they try to say, no, it's only the Bernie people.
Yeah.
But really look around and you can see this with everyone. That's the problem. You know, everybody's got to understand, hey, we truly are on the same side. I understand you got a person you prefer, but let's unite against the actual enemy instead of worrying about Susan Sarandon versus Deborah Messing right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the level of pettiness, right? The level of pettiness that has come out, particularly from some pretty popular media personalities, to be quite frank with you, like people who make extremely good money to do this, behaving almost like high school cliques. But the problem is like, you know, it's not that I'm trying to grandstand and say, you know, I'm better than you because I'm above this, but it's that we saw what happened in 2016 and we saw the divisiveness that lasted beyond 2016. And that type of divisiveness is guaranteed to give Donald Trump an advantage. And I'm sorry, there's just not enough space between, let's say, a Bernie Sanders and an Elizabeth Warren for us to wage a scorched earth battle where if Elizabeth Warren gets the nomination, nobody who supported Bernie is going to support her. There's not enough space when you compare them to Donald Trump. Heck, there's not enough space between Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders once we compare them to Donald Trump. And it's like we absolutely have the right to disagree and to argue about policies. But keep in mind, we're going in the opposite direction so long as Donald Trump is in the White House. So if you want Medicare for all, you're going to get far less than that if we allow Donald Trump to remain.
Right. You're going to get Medicare for fewer if this guy stays in office. He's already made it clear that his second term project's likely going to be gutting the safety net programs, Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. So we're going to end up with even fewer people with health insurance if this guy gets reelected. And so there is, you know, to an extent, there is obviously some good that can come out of people having debate, right? You know, my candidate is better. This person is better because of X, Y, and Z. And your person, you know, says this. So that gives me cause for concern. See, that opens up the door for other people to come in and say, well, hold up. No, I disagree with you. And those disagreements during these primaries, those are fine. But when you do reach that level of I refuse right. to listen to you, I refuse to vote for your person because right. of you. I mean, yeah. that reaches a whole level of pettiness. I'm willing to burn down the country because guy was mean to me on Twitter. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is a technique that I know conservatives use, right? They take the very worst of any community, the worst example that they can find, the outlier. And if they can't find one, they'll make up one, right? And then they use that as a representation for the entire community. For example, with the welfare queen. I don't know if anyone has ever found an actual welfare queen, but Ronald Reagan successfully lifted that up as an example to categorize anyone who uses welfare, and they subsequently were able to attack it over the following 40 years. This is exactly what we see left-leaning Democratic consultants and media personalities doing by saying, oh, this random Joe Schmo on Twitter says something horrible, and he is a representation of all of Bernie Sanders supporters. And I'm like, if we're going to use that technique, keep in mind we can do the same thing to you, right? And before we get into the tit and tat, we have to realize the ramifications of this of these kind of actions, right? We're going to divide ourselves to the point where I simply don't like Elizabeth Warren because this one individual on Twitter said something, and it's almost like Brett Stevens. I don't know if you cover that yet, but Brett Stevens got mad over somebody with 9 likes and no retweets, and now it became this huge thing. Well, we have the potential of doing the same thing in this Democratic primary.
Well, and it's also reminiscent of Devin Nunes' cow Twitter account. You know, he made a big stink about something that nobody even noticed. And now you've got this Twitter account that's actually more popular than Devin Nunes. When you amplify it, when you give it the voice, you legitimize it. And that also creates a bit of a problem. And so I guess part of the thing is, like, don't get sucked into it. I cannot tell you, and I'm sure you're probably the exact same way. I delete probably 100 times more tweets than I actually send out. Because I'll sit there, I'll get angry about something, I type it out, and I'm like, no, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. And I wish more people kind of had that mindset. It's easy to get drawn into an argument, but really, at the end of the day, it's not worth it.
Here's the gag, right? Here's what's actually happening underneath this. Normal people would do exactly what you just described. But what's going on is that there are career opportunities. There's money. There's an opportunity to move up if you become a solid, let's say, if you solidly oppose Bernie Sanders, there's a career path for you, right? There's money that's involved. There's writing opportunities. And so people intentionally get on Twitter to do just that. And the same thing, like you get on Twitter to oppose anyone but Sanders, right? There's a huge audience that you can benefit from if you become the super Saiyan of Sanders supporters. I honestly didn't plan that alliteration, but it worked out, right? And so there's like tens of thousands of people who will start following you immediately because they need that kind of champion on social media. So people are doing this as a performance. It's very performative, and they're doing it intentionally. And there's one other group I want to keep you your audience aware of. There are Donald Trump supporters who are disguising themselves as never Bernie or never Warren, and they're doing it intentionally to divide us. And you can see that more and more and more. They can't really disguise their language that well. But I've seen more and more people that I'm like, okay, this is obviously they're a real person. Like, I'm not saying they're a Russian bot or anything like that, but what they are, they're operatives that are there simply to divide us.
And I think another big point of this is with Bernie and Warren, because we saw earlier this week, you know, you had that New York Times piece come out, and I saw a lot of people, a lot of friends on Twitter who were tweeting out this New York Times story about Elizabeth Warren essentially saying she wants to kind of rebuild the Democratic Party infrastructure from the inside. And they took it and they're tweeting it out saying, see, she's establishment. She wants to, you know, work with the party elites. But when you read the article, it says, no, she's just telling them, listen, I'm going to help you. I'm going to fundraise with you. We're going to do these things, but we're going to do it my way, basically. Whereas, right. you know, and it also mentioned in the article, Bernie is the opposite. He says, listen, we got to get rid of what we got and we got to start over. And right. neither approach is necessarily wrong, but they're miscategorizing Elizabeth Warren in a lot of ways. And I've said repeatedly, Bernie right now is at the top of my ticket. Elizabeth Warren is a very, very close number two.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it's the same from.
Yeah. And I have to defend Elizabeth Warren far more than I have to with Bernie, because unfortunately, you do see a lot of poison out there mischaracterizing things that she has said and done, implying that in some way she's some kind of secret corporatist when there's nothing right. in her history that right. would ever suggest she would rule for corporations over the people.
You know, if we had to, if we're Bernie is my first pick, just like you. Elizabeth Warren is a close second. It's because I believe Bernie would go in with a wrecking ball and try to accomplish what is on his agenda, right? I think Elizabeth Warren would not go in with a wrecking ball, but she has an agenda that will move the ball forward. Now, just because he goes in with a wrecking ball doesn't mean he's going to get anything more done than Elizabeth Warren would with her strategy from working within the existing apparatus. That's my view of the two of them. Neither one of them are so different than the other that I'm willing to go to war. I do not. I'm honestly, this is where I am. I used to be like the King Bernie bro, right? However you want to describe that, that was me. But I just don't believe in politicians anymore. I don't really care. I have no more affection or affinity towards Bernie Sanders than I do Elizabeth Warren. All I care about are the policies. And whoever is going to champion the policies that I want, that's who I support. And that's the extent of it. What we have going on is an obscene amount of cult of personality that's driving this. Like, people are just in love. They are enamored with Bernie Sanders. And I get it. I totally get it. But at the same time, like, you know, Bernie's only going to be able to accomplish so much. So what's going to happen in 4 years after Bernie is president and he can't accomplish like 50% of what he promised you? You're going to be disillusioned. You're going to be distraught. You're not going to want to participate. But you have to understand how this system works and not attach yourself to the personality of a politician, but attach yourself to the policies of the politician.
You know, that's something Mike Papantonio here from Ring of Fire had been talking about. You know, as far back as during the Bush administration, he said, you know, when you tie yourself to the person, you know, or you tie yourself or tie your religion to a politician, political party, it rises and falls with that politician.
Absolutely.
So when something happens to the politician, when they retire, when they get, you know, mired down in a scandal, your belief in everything falls with them. So mm-hmm. put it in ideals, you know, yes. put it in goals. And I agree with you on the cult of personality. And we do have it. Again, this is something that really does cover the board. And I see it a lot. And I'm going to, you know, probably get hit pretty hard on Twitter for this. The Yang Gang.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Like, I don't even think, like, the only one you could remotely compare to Bernie Sanders' cult of personality is the Yang Gang, for sure. And then I think Tulsi's crew would be a close third to that. And I get it. Like, it's very, especially with someone like Bernie Sanders, he's been fighting this fight for his entire life, it seems. Like, he's been fighting it longer than most of us have been alive. And so it's very easy to get lulled into that whirlwind of the Bernie campaign and feeling the burn. But at the same time, like, that drives the online pettiness. And I'm not saying it doesn't drive it from the Bernie side. It's when people see your fanaticism. That's what gives the Yang Gang or anyone else who opposes Bernie Sanders or the establishment, that's what gives them their fire. That's what they have this. That's how they created the Bernie Bros in the first place. But you strip that away from them and argue policy. Forget about Bernie as an individual. Argue his policies. And then they'll find themselves, the establishment will find themselves not fighting against Bernie Sanders, which is easy to do. They'll find themselves fighting against Medicare for All, which is a lot more difficult. Have them fight you based on the policies, not the personality.
I think that's a really good point to make, especially because, look, Bernie, it's kind of obvious. You know, the campaign slogan is not me, us. You know, even he is like, hey, let's do this together. Don't, you know, I'm not this savior guy. We're going to fight and we're all going to fight. You know, don't just say that Bernie's going to fix this. No, we're going to get active. And more importantly, we're going to stay active. Yeah. This is not a campaign. This is not an election. This is a movement that we're all going to be a part of. And to an extent, I feel like Elizabeth Warren is almost the same way. And honestly, I do have to say, if Elizabeth Warren had jumped in the race in 2016,
yeah,
Bernie would not have run. He would have thrown his support behind Elizabeth Warren, I believe. And I think you and I would be having a much different conversation, not just today, but likely every day on our shows. We yeah. would be having different conversations. But, you know, so that was a big disappointment that she did not run in 2016. I am glad that she is in now, even though, again, Bernie's my top. I think Elizabeth Warren has awesome ideas. I think she has detailed ideas. And I think a Bernie Warren ticket is virtually unbeatable at this point.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, we have to keep in mind, that's a very real possibility. I mean, a Bernie Warren Bernie, like whoever's going to be the headliner, we'll see that's really dependent. This is the last thing about this that I think I want to make sure I point out. It really boils down to now who's going to run the better campaign, who has a better infrastructure, who has more boots on the ground, who can get more people out to the polls. So it's not a reflection of America or the Democratic Party or the establishment. No, it's a reflection of who has better organizing skills, whether or not they're going to be at the top of the ticket. But there's a very real possibility that we'll have a Warren Bernie or a Bernie Warren ticket come 2020. And we cannot undermine that possibility by being so petty right now.
You know, we caught a bunch of flack in 2016, and I'm sure you did too, because even after Hillary became the nominee, when a story came out that was unflattering towards Hillary, we still talked about it. You know, we reported on it, and people said, no, you're destroying her chances. And, you know, our response at the time was, listen, we're not cheerleaders for any particular candidate or party. If news comes out, we're going to talk about it because that's our job. That's our responsibility to our audience. And I think a lot of some of the nastiness we see online today, we still have a lot of holdovers who are looking to blame somebody. You know, we still get blamed. They still come after us and say, you cost Hillary the election. You know, Susan Sarandon did. You know, whoever it is, David Sirota cost her the election. And we had Sirota on our program countless times. But that's not how it works. You know, we did not throw the 2016 election. We still, when we do these bad stories, we would say at the end, but vote for Hillary because she's better than Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And I think people need to understand that, listen, sometimes our job here in the progressive media is going to be unpleasant. You know, we're going to have to say that, hey, this person we really like did a bad thing. You know, I personally like Obama. I think he's a good human being and I really like him. But when he screwed up, we had to talk about it. You know, sometimes we still have to bring up things like, yeah, he did a really bad job on this. But I always do make sure to point out, I like him as a person. You know, I have no qualms with him as a family guy, as a moral human being. I think he's great. And so I think people have to understand that, yeah, sometimes we have to go after these people. It doesn't mean we hate them. It doesn't mean that they're the worst person in the world. It just means, hey, here's a problem. You need to fix it. But, you know, anytime we do that, we get these mobs coming for us saying, how dare you? You know, how can you say this? How can you trash this person's life? And it's no, we didn't like the thing they did here. And we're just telling you about that.
Yeah, and I think that directly ties into what we've been talking about, right? So, you know, if you're tied into the personality of the politician, then you're going to be hypersensitive about anything someone says. But if you're tied into the policies, then you're sober enough to be able to say, okay, they screwed up that policy, but they are the person who's going to get us closest to the other policies that we want. So that's how you consciously make the decision that, hey, Obama may have messed up on this, but he's still our best chance for that. Bernie Sanders, once he gets in office, he's going to mess up on this, but he's still our best chance to get that. Now, what I do want to say this to your audience, that what I'm saying now is rather idealistic, right? It is really wishful thinking. It's kind of utopian to believe that American politics can be based on policy and not personality. However, we have to start moving towards that, because the opposite is what we have right now. Everything is driven by passion. Everything is driven by anger, and everything is driven by the cult of personality. And if that's the extent of our political participation, then that is quite literally one of the reasons we have the system as we have it right now. And if we really want to overcome the system as we have it right now, part of that calculus has to include moving away from policy and moving towards policy.
That is absolutely correct. Listen, it's one thing, and I encourage people to debate policies and candidates on the left. Debate, not name called, not throw your Twitter account away and say, I'm never coming back because these people were horrible. Have spirited debate, but remember, the people we're actually fighting against, the people who do think it's okay to lock folks in cages, you know, to discriminate against other people based on, you know, the color of their skin or their sexuality or their religion, those people are the enemy. The people on this same side, we're getting a little ticky-tacky about, you know, who can enact a policy best. I'm glad we're talking policy, but we got to remember the people over there literally don't care if we live or die. And those are the people that we need to be arguing with.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Ben Dixon, the host of the Benjamin Dixon Show. Thank you very much for talking with me today.
Aaron, it's always a pleasure, man. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. Thank you. One of the things that we have to be aware of as we head into the 2020 election is that we can't make the same mistakes of 2016. And what I'm saying is we don't necessarily need to relitigate what happened in 2016, but what we do have to do, which we didn't do in 2016, is we have to give non-voters a reason to go to the polls. And there's a lot of reason people didn't vote in 2016. You know, maybe it was repressive voter ID laws, or maybe, just maybe, they felt that none of the candidates had anything to offer that would help their lives. And joining me now to talk about how we can help motivate these non-voters, how we can get more people involved, is Luke Savage from Jacobin Magazine. Now, Luke, you wrote a piece recently, America Needs a Non-Voter Revolution. And when you get right down to it, you know, the non-voters, it's almost equal to the people who actually vote. I mean, we do and always have, for the most part, had a very big non-voter problem here in the United States, haven't we?
Oh, yeah. I read somewhere, I think it was, I think the source was the New York Times, that, none of the above would have won every presidential election for at least the last century. The United States has one of the lowest voter turnouts consistently in the developed world. So it's a really big problem.
So is, you know, you mentioned in your piece at the beginning here, talking about these voter ID laws, you know, Wisconsin had one. They're trying to push it in some other swing states. Obviously, you know, even Texas has voter ID law here in Florida. They're pushing it. So that plays a role too, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Wisconsin was a good place to kind of start the investigation, because it's somewhere as a local official with Milwaukee's Elections Commission told the New York Times in November 2016, there were recently a bunch of voter ID laws that had just been put on the books by the then Republican Governor Scott Walker. Ari Berman over at Mother Jones has been doing really tremendous reporting on voter suppression laws, voter ID laws, things like that. He's been doing that for years. And I would encourage people to check it out. So that is definitely a big part of the story. And in Milwaukee in particular, which is where this New York Times reporter, Sabrina Tavernise, who I mentioned at the beginning of the piece, where she was visiting after the election, she found that that was definitely a part of the story. But it's really not the whole story of non-voters. You know, voter suppression is not the reason why tens of millions of people don't vote in elections. So I was interested in kind of unpacking a little bit more about why that was, and also in finding out a little bit more about who are these people, who do they tend to be. It's pretty fascinating the extent to which non-voters, given the scale of the constituency they represent, don't really feature in election coverage. There's been a lot of focus on Russian bots, things like that, on third party voters, people that voted for Gary Johnson or Jill Stein, and how that supposedly was a decisive factor in the election. But there is much less attention paid to, the 40% or more than 40% of eligible voters who sat the election out. And when you think about it, it's quite amazing. I mean, obviously, non-voters are not a monolithic constituency, but can you envision another scenario in which there would be such a sizable voting bloc that was, essentially left out of election coverage, or at least like played only a very minor role in it? So I was interested in kind of unpacking that a little bit.
It's really interesting because in the last week or so, I guess Susan Sarandon has obviously been a little bit more active on Twitter these last couple weeks. And so anytime she does, you get the people coming out saying, oh, thanks for Trump, because you told people to vote for Jill Stein in Wisconsin and Ohio. And they post the vote totals and say, see, she got more votes than Trump won by. Susan Sarandon lost the election for Hillary Clinton. But OK, the non-voters, though, those numbers are so much higher than what Jill Stein got. And so this is a great point to make, and it's a great discussion to have. And part of it, we'll get into the actual results here in just a second, but part of it has to do with excitement. You know, when we look back at 2008, actually, you know what? Let's go back even before that. Let's go to the 2000 election. Al Gore was about as exciting as a bowl of mashed potatoes. 2004, you had John Kerry. Also, no charisma, no excitement, wasn't necessarily offering anything other than, I'm not George W. Bush. Kind of what Al Gore offered in 2000, where it's like, hey, let's get another 4 years of Clinton. Everybody's doing great, right? But then 2008, you had this Obama guy burst onto the scene. He was new. He was fresh. He was exciting. He was charismatic. You know, we didn't know anything about what his policies would or wouldn't be, but he was promising us hope and change, promising us something different than what we had had. Obviously, we're in a horrible recession in 2008. People wanted something different, wanted something better. He says he'll have it. It doesn't hurt that he's obviously the first African-American major party ticket candidate. So yeah, that was exciting. And then Hillary Clinton in 2016, it was just, I'm not Trump, so vote for me. You remember the Clintons of the 90s? Hey, we're back. It's the same old, same old. And people, they don't get excited about the same. They wanted something different. They wanted a better promise. They wanted a better future. And as I just, I mean, three of the last four, Democratic candidates didn't offer that at all. I mean, Obama didn't live up to it to an extent, but the other three just said, hey, let's just go back to the way things were. And that's not going to make anybody excited to go to the polls.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think, when you kind of analyze these non-voters, it seems to be overwhelmingly what they say. And in 2016, that proved pretty decisive. I think maybe the best illustration of that is Michigan. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe that Trump won the state. It was a very small margin, less than 3 points, maybe even less than 2 points, something like 19,000 votes. But there was a sizable number of people, I think around 40,000, Again, I'll have to check the number, dig up the numbers later, but who actually did go to vote, but they voted down ballot and they left the presidential ballot blank because they were so contemptuous of having to choose between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Motivation is absolutely key. I mean, those are people who did actually, bother to go and vote. There's a whole other story to be told about all the people who didn't even do that. And that story was partly told in this New York Times piece that I cited at the beginning of mine, in which the reporter spoke to voters in Milwaukee. And, they said very much the kinds of things you'd expect. Both of them were terrible. They don't do anything for us. I felt cornered by the choice between Trump and Hillary. The choice between two candidates like that is not really a choice. They say those kinds of things. And non-voters are much more likely. I suspected this when I started researching the piece, but and found it confirmed. Non-voters are more likely to be racialized. They're much more likely to be lower income than people who do vote. I've found a very good book, or at least the chapter I read was very good. Authors Lely and Nagler were looking at non-voters. This was in 2014, so it didn't have data from 2016, but I think it's still relevant. And they found something very interesting, which was that, people that don't vote, who tend to be lower income, are less likely to perceive ideological differences between major candidates. If you don't vote, there's a good chance it's because you don't see the elections as being much of a choice. And they concluded that if candidates took positions which were perceived by poorer voters to offer more distinctive choices, the income bias in voting would decrease, which is another way of saying more poor people would vote. And in addition to that, there's good reason to believe that non-voters, many of them have their political views insofar as those can be measured, kind of tilt left of center. They favor expanding the social safety net. They favor wealth redistribution, things like that. So this is a huge constituency to be tapped if a presidential candidate or a major party is willing to, offer these people something. And one of the big stories for the past kind of 30 or 40 years in American politics is that, there's been a bipartisan consensus between the leaderships of both major parties, which is, profoundly uninterested in, people that make less than $30,000 a year, and which is absolutely not really catering to their needs. So, you don't have to look too far to understand why so many people stay home.
And I think one of the things too is that, well, here's a great example. We had a poll that came out earlier this week. It said 70% of people, voters here in the United States, they're angry. And they're angry because they believe that the current setup of American politics only benefits those at the top. I mean, 70% of people in this country say that, look, it only benefits those at the top. And so when you take that into consideration, you can understand why so many people in this country want to say, listen, yeah, I understand. I got to go vote and maybe I will go vote. But what's the point in voting for the person at the top when if it's a Democrat or if it's a Republican, nothing they do is going to benefit me? They want to pass these tax cuts that are going to the top. They talk about deregulation, which, okay, that doesn't, I don't benefit from that. Where's the person who's going to come out there and say, listen, you're struggling. I'm here to help. And here is what I'm going to do. That's what people want to hear. That's what these latest polls are telling us. People want solutions to their problems, not these, far off or mysterious things like, oh, the debt and the deficit. Isn't that a huge deal? Well, the average person actually doesn't care about it. They don't even understand if it really affects us, and economists can't even agree on whether or not it actually has any kind of impact on us here in the United States. What they care about, as the polls are telling us, are you going to give me health care? Am I going to be able to afford my insulin under your administration? And I think what we've seen so far from most of the Democratic candidates is they understand this. And that's why most of them, the good ones, the ones who keep going up in the polls, they're out there talking about issues that actually affect people who do not work on Wall Street. And that is a huge difference from what we've seen for the last 20 years in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think another part of the story here is the, you know, intense emphasis on personality that has tended to dominate elections and you know, primary races as well. And just, you know, following up on what you said, I mean, yeah, so candidates like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, you know, seem to be doing very well at the moment. And they're running on a much more kind of programmatic, they're running much more programmatic kinds of campaigns than, you know, we've typically seen from Democrats, and also obviously campaigns that are, you know, significantly to the left of anything Democrats have run on in the past. But moreover, you know, there have been other candidates who have gotten a lot of, you know, press attention, a lot of mainstream media coverage, and who have been less programmatic, and they don't seem to be motivating people to anything like the same extent. You know, it hasn't seemed to matter. You know, consultants and you know, elite pundits and things like that, deeming candidates like Beto O'Rourke or Pete Buttigieg as, you know, the most gifted politicians in a generation or something like that. That kind of hyperbole has not seemed to attract much real organic support to these candidates. The candidates who are currently doing well, you know, Joe Biden is a bit of a complication here. I think a lot of his support seems to be quite soft and less enthusiastic. But the candidates who seem to be doing the best on the Democratic side are the two who have, you know, relatively ideologically coherent, you know, diagnoses of what's wrong in American society and have some kind of a program through which, you know, to address that. And I think you know, it's there's a whole other you know, line of inquiry here about why that is. Why is the kind of old style liberal personality politics not working as well? But you know, maybe part of that is 2016 and this story of Hillary Clinton really failing to motivate so many people and losing the election as a result. Perhaps people are starting to understand that style of politics is increasingly not viable any longer.
What you know, doesn't Joe Biden kind of represent the same thing though? I mean, if Joe Biden's whole campaign right now is, hey, remember the Obama years? Weren't those fun for everybody? Let's do that again. It's not promising anything better or new. It's just saying, hey, let's kind of go back to normal. You know, nothing super great, nothing super bad. Just you go about your daily life and you don't have to read crazy tweets every day. But that's not even what people want. And you know, a couple weeks ago, Center for American Progress Action Fund actually, you know, pays this consultant thousands of dollars to come up with a good campaign strategy. And the strategy is talk about how much Trump tweets. Okay. People know that. You're not going to get people to the polls by saying, wow, the president's really crazy on Twitter, isn't he? No, everybody knows that. And some people actually support him more because of it. What you've got to do to get these non-voters to say, you know what, this is, yeah, I'm in, is you have to say, we understand you're going through things. Things are bad for you. Things may be great up on Wall Street. you know, maybe not the last 2 weeks, but overall, the top 1%, they're doing great. And that's awesome for them. But we're not going to coddle them anymore. We're going to help the people who actually are the backbone of the country. And that's the middle class, the underclass, the working class, the people who go out there, they spend money, they make our products. We're going to help you. We're going to give you healthcare. We're going to, you know, let your kids go to college without worrying about $100,000 student loan debt. That is going to get people energized and active. It may not be enough to get the entire 40% of non-voters to the polls, but I think we would see a huge reduction in the number of people who just say, to hell with it, I'm not voting.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up Biden. I mean, I think Biden is very much an attempt to repeat this kind of the same formula. You know, I think that Center for American Progress research, if you can call it that, you know, is part of the same phenomenon here. You know, part of this has to do with the current leadership of the Democratic Party. You know, they don't want to build a sort of majoritarian coalition. You know, they would be, I'm sure they'd be happy to have working class voters, you know, come out to the polls for them. But they're not really, you know, often they haven't really been willing to offer those people anything. You know, there's, you know, moral blackmail is kind of the motivator that they try to use the most. I think particularly at the presidential level, you know, Democrats, you know, strategists and consultants and the party leadership have, you know, been quite content to try to eke out these razor thin electoral college victories and then, you know, continue governing in much the same way. You know, there's no way to there's no way to bring out tens of millions of non-voters that doesn't involve a major shift in the way that, you know, the would-be center-left party in American politics, you know, conducts its business. And with a candidate like Joe Biden, I mean, that, you know, that is yet another attempt to kind of just push the reset button and say, hey, you know, the Trump thing is a blip. It was kind of an accident of history. It's not, you know, it's not the conclusion of a story that's kind of, you know, decades long and has to do with the you know, rot of American democracy and the, you know, the increasing rigging of the economy and the political system towards those with wealth and power. No, we just need to press the reset button and get a kind of, you know, a bad Obama nostalgia vehicle back in the White House. I personally am of the view, increasingly of the view, looking at Biden's campaign, that's not going to work. You know, the Democratic primaries, I think, are going to be very interesting for that reason, because, you know, I don't think there's been another time in living memory where you had there has never been a figure, you know, until recently, like a Bernie Sanders, who is just kind of openly saying, you know, both parties have failed to represent the American working class. You know, they've become indebted to Wall Street, to Silicon Valley, to, you know, lobbyists, to, you know, institutional power. And we just have to do away with all that or nothing's going to change. And I think that that message can end up being the most powerful, you know, the most powerful motivator of all. When you see these polls like the one you cited, or there was one I found researching the piece that said something like 2/3 of the American population agree with the statement. And this is among people that do vote. They agreed with the statement that neither Republicans nor Democrats do an adequate job representing the American people. So the current system is not popular, and there are huge numbers of votes to be won in openly rebelling against it and not playing nice with it. You know, it's not that there's a lot of organic support out there for this bipartisan consensus, even though it can kind of seem that way when you read, you know, a lot of kind of marquee newspapers, when you hear elite pundits, or when you watch cable news. It can sort of seem like you know, there's actually a lot of support for these things, and clearly there isn't. It's an imperfect example, but I mean, if you look back to the GOP primaries last time, you know, Donald Trump in his own you know, incredibly demented way, you know, and in a kind of explicitly racist way, ran against this whole system. You know, he ran against kind of deference to the talking heads, you know, deference to the Republican establishment. He ran against deference to the media, and that was supposed to render his campaign completely, you know, he was supposed to just tank. There were attempts to sort of cancel him over and over again and say, okay, well, that's it. You know, you can't attack John McCain. It's over now. And he just kept rising in the polls. And obviously the Republican primary electorate is not a particularly good sample if we're talking about the American population in general. But I do think that it shows that there's, you know, tremendous, you know, rebelling against the system and you know, advancing this populist message, which says, hey, the system is rigged against you. It's rigged against ordinary people. It's rigged against the working class. I think that could end up being the most powerful motivator of all for non-voters.
And the best part about that message is that it's absolutely true. You know, we can't deny that. You know, they can't look at the policies. And this is something I bring up on my show all the time, is the fact that I would love, and I've been asking for months and so far, nada. I would love any person out there to send me one of Trump's policies that has benefited American workers. You know, just send me a link, send me something to say that this policy benefited only American workers. This was for them and they did it. Or furthermore, you know what? Go back and send me something Bush did that actually just benefited the middle class. I mean, they really don't. And if Democrats just hammer that home, and if they say, listen, we are for you, but more importantly, show that we are for you. I mean, look at what Bernie Sanders has done in just the last 2 weeks. He sent the pizzas to, in a show of solidarity, to the protesters of the coal train, the coal miners who have not been paid in months now. He went and he stood in picket lines with AT&T workers in South Carolina. You know, and in the past, he has shown up at other union protests. He has shown the people, listen, I'm not just saying I want to do these things. Here I am. I'm standing next to you fighting for them. And that, to me, those images are just so powerful that you know this is what he is standing for here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that is the message. You know, it's the 99% against the 1%. It's ordinary, you know, working class people against the oligarchy. And, you know, in addition to, you know, it has the virtue of being being true and being accurate, as you said, but it's also a powerful motivator. And, you know, again, this is an area where kind of the pundit class or most of it, you know, tells us that, you know, polarization is bad. We shouldn't want it. But also, it's not a way to win elections. You know, that's kind of the standard pundit analysis of how elections are won. You know, that there's a big moderate majority in the middle, and then each party has a kind of base of more people that have more extreme views, yada yada. So you win elections from the center. But you know, that theory has been tested over and over and over again for the past 25 years or longer, really. And it's failed over and over again. You cited the examples of Democratic candidates like Al Gore, who lost, or, you know, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton. You know, Barack Obama, you know, was very much a centrist, but I think, you know, he didn't exactly run a centrist campaign in 2008, or at least that's not how people perceived it. You know, he was perceived by many people, you know, myself included. I was an undergraduate at the time. I was very excited about Obama. You know, we perceived him as a, you know, populist, anti-war candidate. You know, he'd been against the Iraq War, and he was going to take on Wall Street. You know, and that has been the most successful formula for winning elections, even though with Obama it turned out to be kind of a sham act. But you know, Bill Clinton is the other Democrat who won two elections, although I think, you know, he got a big assist both times from Ross Perot.
Yeah.
You know, this is how it needs to be done. You know, people should ignore the concern trolls from elite pundits and cable news talking heads that say all elections are won from the center. It's just not true, and it doesn't stand up to scrutiny when you look at American elections, particularly how Democrats have campaigned at the presidential level for the past few decades. The route to victory is by bringing in people from you know, who sat elections out, who are disillusioned, who are not served by American institutions. It's an absolutely huge voting block. But doing that means breaking decisively from the, you know, what has been kind of the dominant mode of politics, liberal politics, for decades, you know, targeting, you know, affluent, you know, suburban voters, you know, catering platforms to, you know, suit their needs and kind of running on personality. That hasn't worked, and it really is time to try to do something different.
Absolutely. And let's hope they go forward with that mindset. And so far, as we mentioned, the top two folks, they absolutely are. You have to be different. You have to do something different. Same old isn't going to cut it. And hopefully, you know, when the primary voting starts, the voters are going to pick the two people who understand that we have to give the middle class something to vote for. We have to give them a reason to get out of their house. We have to fulfill those promises once we're elected. Luke Savage, Jacobin Magazine. Luke, it's been phenomenal talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Progressive primary challengers are popping up all over the map, taking on Democrats who have been in office for years. And of course, most of these Democrats who are being challenged have one thing in common, and that is they all tend to be slightly too corporatist for what this country needs today. And I am joined now by one of these primary challengers, Lauren Ashcraft, running for Congress in New York's 12th district. Lauren, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to speak with you.
So before we actually get into, any issues, and I know you've got a lot of issues you'd like to talk about, I do want to ask, because I am curious, and it's inspiring to know these things, what made you decide this is it? This is now. This is my time. I'm going to do this.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I grew up just being keenly aware of why we need everyday people who are passionate about standing up for the right things to be our representatives. So on one side of my family, my grandmother is an immigrant from Japan, and she met my grandfather who was serving in the U.S. Air Force in the 50s. They had my father and came back over to West Virginia where my grandfather was from, where my grandfather, unfortunately, he became a coal miner to feed his family and was killed in the 1968 Farmington mine disaster, leaving my newly immigrated grandmother with close to nothing and in a strange country in a foreign language with kids. So I just grew up being very, very aware of what it's like for my family members to have survived on pennies and to survive on very small social security checks, and hearing about, you know, there's income caps on people contributing to Social Security, and why is this program not a priority? Why aren't we pushing to expand it whenever so many people rely on it for unforeseen circumstances? And on the other side of my family, my grandfather was a very hardworking mechanic and owned a small trailer repair shop, and one day he fell and became a quadriplegic, unfortunately. So I also grew up, my family taking care of my grandfather and also watching him be ignored by representatives and laws such as the Americans with Disabilities Act, which has not gone far enough to put the burden of enforcement on the federal government. If you actually walk around New York City, which is one of the richest cities in the world, you notice all of the places where you have to step up into a building or into a public space or into public transit. And these are all the places that someone with a wheelchair is excluded from. And if you are surviving from disability payments, you survive on a very small amount of money. And it's really not enough to live off of, especially in New York City. It's not enough to, you know, feed your family on. And now if we're expecting for people with disabilities to be the ones to enforce the Americans with Disabilities Act, it just goes to show that representation has not gone far enough to advocate for everyone. And I'm running to get big money out of politics, and I have some ideas about how to do that. I feel as though representatives have paid largely the most of their attention to where their big donations are coming from. Unfortunately, a lot of that is corporate tax. For my representative, I am running a 100% grassroots campaign, and I want to make sure that people are the priority and we empower the people instead of having people represent us, but unfortunately spending their energy representing corporations and profit instead.
You know, I want to touch on something that you've brought up here, and that is that we have people that have been serving in D.C., some of them for three decades or more, you know, 30 plus years working in D.C. as an elected official, a senator, a member of the House of Representatives, whatever it is. And when they stay there that long, no matter where they came from or what they grew up with, they lose touch, right? Mm-hmm. They don't remember.
Yes.
And most of them, honestly, probably never even had to go through, you know, having your debit card declined. And this is a story I tell frequently because it's one that still, you know, rings in my head. About 10 to 12 years ago, I'm at a grocery store buying a little over $12 worth of food, and my debit card was declined. I didn't have $12 to my name. I didn't eat that day. I would like to know which members of Congress have had to do that in the last 12 years. And that now some of the new folks, that wouldn't surprise me. They know. They've been through this. And that is one of the reasons they're so inspirational right now. But some of these people, they have made so much money doing nothing more than just being a representative. And it sickens me to the point, just because you don't remember. You don't remember. Maybe you never went through it, but you probably had friends who did. But you've been removed so long that you forgot about these people, and you forgot that those are the people you're supposed to be going to D.C. to fight for. And I think that is another great reason we need primary challengers.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And one of the biggest examples of this is the fact that we don't yet have something like single-payer Medicare for all. And I have so many examples in my own family of how this system is so broken. I myself went to the doctor a couple weeks ago and had to get a biopsy at my doctor's recommendation, and ended up, I am insured, I'm employed, and I ended up with a close to $600 bill from coinsurance. And whenever I got that bill, like, I got a sinking feeling in my stomach, and that's just, it's ridiculous that we haven't moved to a single-payer Medicare for all system, in which this coinsurance and in-network and out-of-network, and people losing their insurance whenever they're laid off from their jobs, or you're putting off going to get treatment because you're worried about the bill, and in the meantime, your symptoms are getting worse, and you're setting yourself up for a longer road of recovery, if you can even recover from waiting that long going to the doctor. So there's so many examples of how these representatives are so out of touch, and with so many people dying across the country because they waited too long for treatment, people rationing their insulin because it's so expensive. It just shows that there haven't been enough advocates in Congress for these last decades that should have been very vocal every single day about their constituents dying from the lack of action. But instead, a lot of them do accept, you know, private health insurance money and big pharmaceutical money, and unfortunately prioritize that over the lives of the people they swear to represent.
And, you know, Medicare for All is obviously, I think at least right now, for the 2020 election, not just on the presidential side, but for all the races, that's the biggest issue. I mean, there's a great argument to be made that climate change is the biggest issue. But unfortunately, even though that has to be addressed and we're, you know, clock's ticking on that issue, unfortunately, you still can't motivate enough people with that issue. So Medicare for All is a good substitute, you know. Because the people fighting for Medicare for All are also fighting very strongly for the environment. So it's good to know that. But people also have to understand that it's not just the presidential candidate that you like. Do they support Medicare for All? Everybody in this country has a representative. Everybody in this country has two senators. You know, the representatives are all up for re-election in 2020, just as they are every 2 years. Find out what that person stands for. But more importantly, it's not just what they say on paper or what they say in a speech, because everybody can give wonderful, rousing speeches. Follow the money. And to me, that is what really separates you from your the representative you're primarying, Representative Carolyn Maloney, who, you know, I looked at and you know, you and I had a brief discussion earlier, and I said, well, she looks great on paper. You know, she stands for the right things eventually, as you pointed out. And then you look at her money. Let's go to this. For her career total, she's gotten over $2 million from securities and investment, you know, $1.4 million from real estate, $872,000 from insurance, commercial bank, $717,000. And this is all readily available in Open Secrets. And that is a tool I've been using for 15 years here on Ring of Fire. And I wish more people used it, because that is where you need to go. You know, check them out on the issues, which is great too. But you've got to look at those Open Secrets. And to me, that is where the story is told. Not in their voting record, not in what they say on their speeches. Well, in the voting record, yes. But that voting record, the story's told in that Open Secrets page. That's where all the info is. That's where their loyalty lies.
Yeah, and all of these corporate PACs, they don't just hand out money for fun. They want a return on their investment. So, you know, again, yes, you're very, very right. Follow the money. And with all of the real estate money going to my representative, it's no wonder that housing is not affordable at all in this district and across New York City and across the country. With all of the big real estate money just going to these representatives, it's truly shameful that, you know, I have worked for a nonprofit that builds affordable housing for people in Mercer County, Pennsylvania in my past, and housing is a human right. And that is absolutely what we need someone in Congress vocalizing and advocating. But how are you able to do that if you're accepting all of the big real estate money?
And, you know, one of the things, and again, you and I briefly spoke before we were on here today, is that you have a lot of people in Congress, and this even goes, you know, applies to President Obama, who change their position after they see that, oh, the public does want or doesn't want this thing. Okay, I will reluctantly go along with what the public says. And I think we see that a lot with Carolyn Maloney. As I mentioned, we saw it with Obama on both the Keystone and the Dakota Access pipelines. He kind of stayed out of it for the longest time, waiting to see which way the wind was going to blow. And when he realized, oh, wow, there's a lot of public backlash, I'm going to come out and say, you know what? I know this has been going on for years, but I'm going to go ahead and say, no, we're not going to do it, because I see that's what the public wants me to say. We don't need that. We don't need somebody who just sits there and says, well, hold up now. Let me see what people say. No. Be the leader on the issue and come out and say, listen, yeah, we're going to get Medicare for all. And I don't care if only 10% of the public wants it. They'll come around. And look, lo and behold, last couple of years, they came around, and they came around big time.
Exactly. Yeah, and I was the first person running in the district, including against Carolyn Maloney herself, that came out publicly calling for impeachment. And I was the first person that came out and saying that we need to have term limits in Congress and with the Supreme Court justices. And I'm really happy about helping to push these topics. I am also against the death penalty federally, and really appreciate Ayanna Pressley's bill that calls for abolishing the death penalty federally. And I am watching Carolyn Maloney to see if she co-sponsors that bill. But these topics, I think it's really important to stand up for what you want, even if you hurt yourself politically a little bit by doing so. Because like you said, the right thing for us healthcare-wise is single-payer Medicare for all, and the people have come around because there are campaigns right now to, you know, knock on doors and have town halls and educate people about how this is going to be so much better for everyone. But everyone who really believes strongly in something should be doing the same thing, or having their campaign or their volunteers or their supporters helping to spread the message about everything that they believe strongly about, which is fighting for the environment because we're in this horribly urgent climate emergency, and abolishing the death penalty and calling for term limits. But we're just not seeing that kind of advocacy across the United States with our representatives. And I think that we've seen an enormous amount of change and advocacy from the newest members of Congress, which is exactly what this progressive wave and progressive movement is all about. And we're seeing people that reject that corporate and super PAC money get into office for the right reasons. And people like Carolyn Maloney have not endorsed people like AOC, or also have not endorsed, you know, our district attorney, Tiffany Caban, in her recent race as well, district attorney candidate. And we have this opportunity for people who have been in office for decades to really come out and advocate for the right things and endorse the right people and become part of this movement. But instead, they're just self-proclaiming that they are progressive and they're accepting corporate PAC money. And that is not what progressive politics is. So yes, there's an actual true progressive movement right now of people like myself running across the country for the right reasons. And we are doing it in a grassroots, people powered way. And I'm really excited about being part of this movement and change and pushing District 12 in that truly progressive direction. And I would be truly honored to represent this district.
You know, you you briefly mentioned endorsement, so I'm going to put you on the spot for a minute. If you could get your dream, if you could get your dream endorsement right now from anybody in this country, who would be that one person that you would just absolutely be like, oh my God, this is the best thing in the world? So who would that be if you had to pick?
Well, probably Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, just because she is in the neighboring district and has done so much for her district and for the country. And she has inspired and helped to inspire this movement of progressives like myself, showed us that it's possible to do it without millions of dollars and lots of really high up contacts. And I would love her endorsement. Tiffany Caban as well, Bernie Sanders. I would take them all.
Well, listen, hey, that was a phenomenal answer. And I love your passion. I love your story. I love what you're doing here. And I hope, you know, I hope that your campaign not only obviously is successful, but I hope, much like AOC, that it does inspire other people. You know, last week I spoke with Isaiah James, you know, who's also running. And there is this progressive movement. There is this progressive wave. People are no longer sitting by and saying, man, if I could just run for Congress, I could maybe change things up. You're doing it. That to me is probably the most inspirational thing imaginable. And, you know, I had toyed around. My representative in Congress is Matt Gaetz. Yeah. So a little embarrassing for us down here. And I had, you know, toyed around, jokingly said on Twitter one time, I'm considering running against him. But I have never actually had the courage to do that. So I applaud each and every one of you out there that is actually doing this and putting yourself out there, taking the time, because it's something I never was able to actually do. I didn't have the commitment to it. So I applaud every single person who does.
Oh, well, thank you. And there's still time if you change your mind. but part of why we're able to do this is because it is this movement. And Isaiah, who you mentioned, we've actually had multiple phone conversations just supporting each other and talking through policy and why we're doing this. And we are this huge community of people that support each other, and I want to get in there together. And the more and more of us that do get in there, the more change and people empowerment you're going to see, which is why it's so important to jump on this wagon and make sure you support these candidates and share their stories. And anyone who's listening that does want to give a $1 every month or $5 every month recurring donation to any of the progressives that are inspiring you right now. I know personally, I see it with my own eyes, and I get really excited every time that someone does contribute, and it makes a huge difference because we are going up against people that just get $700,000 dumped in their accounts on a regular basis. So
the website is laurenashcraft.com. Is that correct?
Yes, and there you will see all of my stances and my story, and there's ways to contact me directly and ask any questions that you have. and an unavoidable big orange donate button.
Well, Lauren, again, I wish you nothing but success. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. And again, everybody, Lauren Ashcraft, New York's 12th District.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, not a problem. I appreciate everything you are doing. So thank you very much. Not that long ago, YouTube was really a great equalizer between both the right and the left. Right-wing media typically gets propped up by some kind of organization or possibly a millionaire, billionaire backer. Progressive media, not so much. And YouTube put us all on an even playing field. But recently, progressive content has been getting dinged left and right for essentially covering the news of the day. Joining me now to talk about this, as well as several other issues, is Mike Figueredo, host of the Humanist Report. Mike, it is a pleasure to have you here on Ring of Fire with me today.
I am really glad to be here. Thank you so much for the invite, Farron.
You know, I've seen you tweet out about it. I've tweeted about it. Everybody on the left pretty much has been talking about this for quite some time. But we've been noticing with YouTube a lot more recently, everything, maybe not everything, but a lot of things just happen to get demonetized. A great example, even when you're talking about something that's not necessarily controversial, LGBTQ issues. If you talk about those, you get demonetized. I think what, up until about 2 days ago, they finally started letting some of those through, talking about social issues. I mean, it's starting to really get out of control with the amount of content that's getting hit here for really no reason whatsoever, isn't it?
It's really difficult to figure out what will and won't work, especially like with LGBTQ issues, because pretty much any video that I put out that was related to LGBTQ plus rights, I mean, I just expect that to be demonetized, although I actually tweeted because I was surprised that after being initially demonetized, the video that I had covered on trans rights was remonetized. And I was actually so shocked that I tweeted about it. And I said, this is like the first time in a while I have been able to monetize a video on trans rights, which is strange because, you know, this double standard where if you are hateful towards LGBTQ people like Steven Crowder, you can monetize that content. But when we put out a response to that, we get demonetized. So it's a little bit frustrating that this was the standard. I mean, I'm assuming up until recently. So it's an indication that hopefully YouTube is changing, because I do think we should be encouraging and incentivizing creators to make LGBTQ plus content. I mean, back when I was a young man, YouTube was a great resource when I was coming out. I would listen to people's coming out stories and whatnot, and it really helped me. So to have that demonetized when I saw this happen, especially after the 2017 apocalypse, it was really, you know, devastating to see that, because, you know, that turns LGBTQ plus creators and allies off to the platform, which I think is a really, really bad sign. And it's not just LGBTQ plus rights. As you know, pretty much we know what will and won't get demonetized. Anything with regard to foreign policy, anything that's a little bit too controversial, it will be demonetized. And, you know, the issue isn't necessarily that it's permanently demonetized. A lot of times we'll appeal when we're initially demonetized, and then they will reinstate the ads. The problem is when you're hosting a news and politics channel like ours, is that first 24 hours is absolutely crucial. If we don't make that revenue then, we're probably not going to do too well on that video overall. So for it to be remonetized, you know, 24 to 48 hours later, that doesn't necessarily help us. So just trying to navigate an ever-changing algorithm, it can be really frustrating.
Well, and that's something that Kyle Kulinski's mentioned a lot, too. You know, his videos get huge traffic. He's got over 700,000 subscribers. And, yeah, they'll demonetize it for the first 12 hours or so. Okay, well, there goes half your traffic. So that's half the revenue off a video just automatically gone, because it got snatched up in some kind of, you know, algorithm or, you know, program looking for certain words. And, yeah, you know, we over the last couple weeks have gotten huge traffic off of talking about Jeffrey Epstein. Well, anytime you mention Epstein, at least on our channel, that video is instantaneously limited advertisers. Just no exceptions. Epstein, you know, gone. And we've got some of those videos that are, you know, hundreds of thousands of views that, you know, maybe make a couple of bucks, but certainly not reflective of the amount of traffic there. And it gets odd because, as you said, you try to navigate it, but at the same time, we have to talk about the news of the day. We can't ignore issues like with the mass shootings. You know, those absolutely have to be discussed, and they, you know, they kill all revenue to any of those. You know, you mentioned the word El Paso in the first week or so after the shooting. That video is gone, even if you weren't talking about the shooting. Mentioning the word shooting is going to get you punished by YouTube. And so it's hard to navigate. And what's really disappointing, and then this is the overall thing, it's not just people saying, oh, I'm mad, I'm not making money. People do this for a living, and these voices are important. You know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, these voices wouldn't exist. People would not have been able to do this because they would have had to, you know, basically find a new way to make a living. And so that's what's harming it here. If this continues, voices will be lost. You know, this is not going to be a job or a career that people are going to be able to pursue if this is not fixed by YouTube.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that would be devastating to political discourse because independent media, even though there are problems and issues with indie media itself, nothing is perfect. You know, we need some force in this country pushing back against the corporate capitalist narrative. And indie media really is, you know, it's the only set of people who are willing to do that. So it is, you know, it's worrying to see this trend. And, you know, right before the adpocalypse, that was when I decided to go full time. I was a PhD student. I was a research assistant. I was going into my second year. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to do something crazy. I'm going to try to do this full time. A couple months later, there was the adpocalypse. Now, I was a little bit lucky because I wasn't hit as hard as someone like Kyle Kulinski or David Pakman. But the long term trend, you know, I've seen that the algorithm doesn't like me as much. And as you've stated, you know, you navigate to an extent, right? Like, we know that if we put shooting in the tags, that's an instant demonetization. So what I would kind of do to get around that and subvert the system was, rather than mention shooting, I would say tragedy. I would name the city, but it's gotten a lot smarter, you know? So now it's picking up on that. So it's just a matter of, like, trying to figure out what to do in order to not get dinged by the algorithm. And at the same time, you know, you do what you can, but really, it's like trying to hit a moving target. It's always changing. And, you know, one week you just feel like, wow, this is all crashing and burning. And the next week you're doing great. So it's so volatile. Like a couple of weeks ago, there was one day I put in like 15, 16 hours editing these long videos. All three of them that I put out were demonetized. And I thought all of this work was for nothing. Like, without member support and patrons, like, this would not be a sustainable business model. Now, all three of those videos were reinstated, but, you know, as you stated, that first few hours, it's absolutely crucial for news and politics. One thing that I've seen, which is pretty clever, for creators that just put out, like, creative artistic content, like ContraPoints, is what they'll do is they'll upload a video to Unlisted, and then they'll wait until it's been reviewed and remonetized, and then they'll make it public, which is a great strategy. It's just something that we can't really do on our shows. I mean, sure, I can do like an interview with a politician or a political analysis that isn't necessarily topical and wait until that's remonetized, but that's not going to work in, you know, 9 times out of 10 instances. So it's absolutely a struggle, and it's difficult because the alternative obviously is member support, patrons, but we're also a left-wing political channel, and you pointed out we don't have right-wing sugar daddies to pick us up when we fall. So I'm bringing on these candidates. I'm asking, you know, please donate $1, $2 to these candidates, whatever you can. And then I'm asking them to contribute to Bernie Sanders, you know. And then I'm saying, hey, if you have an extra couple of bucks to spare, maybe support us on Patreon. So it's difficult. There's a limited amount of resources, and we are not, you know, we're not putting out news that will be appealing to wealthy people. We're speaking to people who are disproportionately disadvantaged and economically and socioeconomically disadvantaged. So it's tough, but for the most part, all that I want to do is be able to pay my bills and do this. I think a lot of us, we're putting the effort because it's a labor of love for us, which is important. You need people who just care. And I think that's what a lot of us want to do. We just want to be able to survive. And that's all we care about. Putting out the content is more important.
And one of the things, and to a degree, it is a little bit lacking right now. And hopefully, I think it is getting better. We all have to support one another too. You know, not just with the audiences supporting us. I think we need to build a better support system, because one of the things you do see among the right wing talkers is they always have each other's backs. You know, even when they come out and say the stupid things, they're all kind of on the same page. And I'm not saying we all need to have the same message, by no means should we. But there needs to be a little bit more camaraderie. And, you know, maybe that's something we all work on in our spare times. Maybe we all get together sometime and go to one of those retreats. But but look, hey, I've fallen in the trap too, right? I've gotten mad and I've said, you know, things that I later regretted and apologized for about some of these other folks. But at the end of the day, we really are all in this together. You know,
absolutely.
Our collective success is what is important here, because when we start falling off or we start picking each other apart, you know, then we've already lost. I think at that point.
You're totally right. I think that it is important that we kind of help each other. I've backed away from that, admittedly, a little bit going into 2018, 2019, because when I first got started, you know, I had to rely on a lot of other people to kind of get a boost myself. And then I started to bring on other people. And, you know, I've made a lot of mistakes. I brought on individuals in indie media who sounded like great progressives. Turns out, you know, they were bad faith actors, you know, people who supported Bernie at first and went to Donald Trump. I'm talking about like H.A. Goodman,
yes,
figures like that.
We did so, too.
yeah. So, you know, it's a matter of trying to be responsible and uplift people, but also be selective in choosing people who are actually in this for, you know, the policy and the end result, and not just doing it, you know, because they're career minded and for the grift. Another person I brought on, sane progressive, I thought, oh, well, you know, there's so few women in this indie media community. We have to uplift, you know, all voices, women included. So I brought her on, you know, about a year after I brought her on my show. She was talking about how Parkland was a false flag, and not to poop on these people too much, you know, that's why I kind of backed off. But I'm getting more comfortable and kind of realizing, you know, who is and isn't real. And I'm absolutely recognizing the importance of really reaching out and kind of collaborating with people and making sure that we all uplift each other, because we may not agree on everything. Everyone has their own imperfections and strengths and weaknesses, but this really is a community, and we all really do have the same overarching goal. If, you know, even if we have a little bit of disagreements ideologically and politically. So I totally agree with the sentiment. We do have to really uplift each other. And that's something that the right has been really great at doing, because they, you know, they all bring on each other whenever somebody is demonetized. We all hear about it. Ted Cruz tweets about it, you know, but the same isn't true for the left wing, you know, indie media sphere. So I think that's a phenomenal point. And I totally agree.
Well, let's move on to something that actually is worth, you know, kind of not necessarily fighting about, but debating. And that is obviously this massive crop of candidates we've got right now in the Democratic Party. And, you know, earlier in the show, I actually spoke with Ben Dixon, and it's true. There is a lot of vitriol on Twitter. You know, we see it. We see these people a lot of times wanting to relitigate 2016. They get personal. They get ugly. And this is coming from everywhere. But there is plenty of room to have sane, rational debate about these people running for president on the Democratic side. And it would be better to see people engaging in that kind of activity rather than just saying, nope, I'm never going to ever listen to you because I don't like you. And now I don't like your candidate because I don't like you. I mean, we see that far too often, but that's the preface. And I do want to talk about the candidates right now. So we've had some good polls come out this week. You know, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren tied for first in the Monmouth poll. Biden, in third place, just 1 point behind them. Other polls still showing Biden ahead. When do you think Biden's dropping out?
Man, you know, I think I'm terrible at predictions, but if I had to guess just based on the trajectory, I think he's going to be there until Iowa. I think he's hanging on until New Hampshire. I think that Super Tuesday is the day where this is really going to come down to like the top two, top three candidates. And it's kind of shaping up, like, I don't want to speak too soon, but it seems like this is shaping up to be a race between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, which is fantastic. You know, these are the better candidates in the race. There's a lot of pretty solid candidates running. But, you know, it would be nice to see Joe Biden drop out, because out of all of the candidates, I feel like he would probably be the weakest choice against Donald Trump. And I understand that early polling is showing that he does perform relatively well against Trump, you know, in these hypothetical matchups. But at the same time, Hillary Clinton did at this point right. in the race as well. And when it gets to that general election and you can no longer hide and you have to face the media, I just feel like we need someone who will excite the base, not go after Republicans and moderates. We need someone to recognize that we are in a polarized political environment. And what you have to do is play to your strength, get that base out, get them excited, register new voters. And really, the people who can do that are the left-wing candidates. So I really, the sooner the better, you know, that's my response to Joe Biden in terms of when he's going to drop out. I don't know when he will drop out specifically, but I just, you know, I see, I've said this on my program before. You know, we are all on the SS Biden ship, and it's as big as the Titanic, and there's an iceberg straight ahead. And look, this is the way I'm thinking about 2020 is not a presidential election. This is a Supreme Court election where Ruth Bader Ginsburg is hanging on, presumably for dear life. And yeah. I don't want Donald Trump to fill that seat. And it's a little bit selfish, right? Because, of course, I care about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's health. But I also care about who controls the Supreme Court. So to me, this is basically about survival. This is about climate change. This is about just making sure that we don't get another 4 years of Donald Trump, which would be just disastrous. So anyone who I see who has red flags, who won't excite the base, I'm speaking out against. And people think that that's overly divisive. You'll see a lot of centrist right. Democrats, celebrities denounce that. I don't care. I don't want Donald Trump to win again. So I'm sorry, Joe Biden, you've got to go.
You know, and see, that's a lot of, you know, my point here, too, is we do have to call these people out for their flaws. And if they're not good enough, it's not just saying that this person's awful. It's you're really bad on these issues. You can either get better or you could not be in the race anymore. But you have issues as a candidate that in the long run is going to cost you dearly. And you have too many people who take that personally. You know, these people out there who support the candidate so deeply that any criticism of their policies, which is what this is policy criticism. They take it as you just insulted, you know, their own family member. And I don't want to get too bogged down in the minutiae, but, you know, I've said a couple things that, you know, we're not necessarily wonderful about some of Andrew Yang's policies. I don't hate Andrew Yang as a person by any stretch of the imagination, but I don't think UBI is a magic bullet for the United States. And that kind of statement is going to get you swarmed on Twitter. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's disappointing because you have to understand that whoever it is you support, they're not without flaws, right? I mean, everybody has flaws. Elizabeth Warren, I love Elizabeth Warren. Starting to see more and more flaws that are making me not as happy as I was with yeah. you know, a month ago or 6 months ago. So we have to accept that. But what we do with that is then say, okay, candidate, you have to be better than this. You have to do better. And that's a lot of what we do when we call these people out. It's not just to say you're bad. It's can you get better than this?
That's exactly right. And it's why we always have to stress this is not about personality. This is about policy. That's all that this is about. Like even Bernie Sanders, he's my number one choice by a mile and a half. But there are areas where he needs to improve. One of those areas was reparations. When he first was talking about it, I was cringing, you know. So these are areas that are there for us to criticize the candidates so they can improve, not to break them down. It's about really building them up. And it's funny that you say that about Andrew Yang. I just put out a video today about Andrew Yang, and I can already see the downvotes. And it's not like he's a bad person. It's just that there's area for growth. And even if I don't support him, I do think that UBI can potentially be a solution. But when Andrew Yang came on my show, I was critical of him, and I asked him, is it really fair that my dad, who's on Social Security, has to choose between UBI and the Social Security that he paid into his whole life, whereas someone who makes $100,000 per year just gets that extra thousand and they don't have to make that choice. Is that really fair? And that criticism was not intended to point out how horrible Andrew Yang is. I wanted him to improve. And a month or so later, he did, you know, adjust his UBI. Now, I still don't want it replacing any of our social safety net.
Right.
But I think that these criticisms, they're constructive. Like on the left, we care about policy. You know, we're glued to the policy substance. And even if we support Bernie Sanders and we have these, you know, these biases in favor of certain candidates over the others, at the end of the day, if somebody is going to be a flawed candidate to a degree, but they're still going to promote a policy idea that could potentially elevate it. Marianne Williamson with regard to reparations is an example. You know, I do think that that's important. So we're trying to build them up, not break them down, because we want to do more than just elect a candidate. We do want to change national discourse. And I think that that's what this is about. If you basically mute yourself and self-censor and say, well, you know, I like Andrew Yang, so I can't criticize any aspect of UBI ever. I mean, well, what's the point? If you truly care about UBI, understand that this is, you know, we need to have a robust conversation. UBI can be implemented in a very left-wing way. It can be implemented in a very right-wing way, which could act as a Trojan horse to gut our social safety net, which I don't want, you know? So these are the discussions that we have to have. And you know, it's not an election if people don't go at each other's throats who are generally allies. So it's par for the course.
Yeah. And, you know, I hope that the discourse does continue. Yeah, I would like to see people maybe not throwing their vitriol, you know, at those of us on the left. There's plenty of people on the right, and you know, maybe some people disagree with me on this, but you know, that's where we need to direct the real actual anger. You know, they're enacting horrible policies. Trump's trade war is destroying farmers' livelihoods across this country. We have children locked in cages, and now they want to lock them in those cages indefinitely. So maybe we save those really harsh criticisms, you know, those horrible words for the people who support that, not the person who, you know, is disagreeing with your candidate's stance on this particular issue. We can debate those all day long, and we should. But the vitriol, there's people who deserve it, but it's not us on the left here, you know? I really Absolutely. Think we need to work on where we're directing the anger and work on policies within our party. And to an extent, honestly, it is better than it was. It is much better than it was. People are understanding that. And you do see these great policy debates. But when people start speaking in absolutes, like with the Electoral College, saying that, nope, this is a dumb idea, we have to keep the Electoral College, and you're stupid if you think we should abolish it, you just lost me there. Because you're clearly Yeah. not open to any kind of criticism or intelligent back and forth on the issue.
Oh, totally. I absolutely agree. And, you know, this Democratic Party civil war, it's going to be an ongoing thing. But one thing that I've kind of become a lot more cognizant of is that, you know, while we're bickering, Republicans are, in fact, you know, they're becoming more powerful. Trump has stacked the judiciary. So it's okay for us to hash out these disagreements, but at the same time, we can't allow Republicans to get a pass, you know, to squeak by and continue to ruin not just the country, but the planet, you know? I mean, Donald Trump is saying nothing while Jair Bolsonaro is getting into these petty back and forths with Emmanuel Macron about, you know, the Amazon rainforest right now while it's burning. So, you know, we have to basically walk and chew gum at the same time. And I think that in 2019, going into the 2020 cycle, I do feel a little bit better knowing that, you know, the left isn't just kind of ignoring the Republican Party. We're having our debate, but at the same time, we're also keeping an eye and, you know, holding Trump's administration accountable. You know, there's been a lot of solidarity, I think, for this impeaching Donald Trump movement that we see, you know, and everyone is kind of, you know, directing their ire towards Nancy Pelosi on, you know, all sides of that Democratic Party civil war. So, you know, little things like this that I feel a little bit optimistic about, although, you know, my level of optimism will hinge on the 2020 election and that outcome mostly.
Well, you know, let's hope the polls keep moving in the way that they're moving. Let's hope right now, the thing I love the most is the fact that the biggest thing happening in the primary is that Elizabeth and Bernie seem to have some kind of, you know, policy competition happening. And that is the kind of thing that has been sorely missing from Democratic politics for you know, 20 years at this point. They're trying to fight with one another to see who can come up with the most comprehensive, and it's not really a fight, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. You know, here's my criminal justice reform plan. Well, here's my plan. Well, here's my environmental plan. Well, here's my environmental plan. They're not arguing that you're not electable or that I'm better than you. It's, I think my policy can go further. I think I can help more people with my policy. And that's the most refreshing thing happening in politics today, to me at least.
100%. You know, it's to see them go tit for tat on something that benefits us, like who's going to benefit us more. I love this. Like when Elizabeth Warren came out and she announced her student loan debt cancellation plan, I said, this is phenomenal. I have been begging Bernie as a supporter to do something about student loan debt. You know, making college free is phenomenal. That's a great solution. But for those of us already burdened with student loan debt, you've got to do something. So she came out with that first. And then my reaction was to praise Elizabeth Warren and then say, okay, Bernie, she left you a little bit of room. She's not canceling 100%. And then, you know, Bernie Sanders came out and canceled, you know, 100%. And to see them go back and forth like this, this is exactly the result that we could ever hope for from a primary. And, you know, comparing this to 2016, the difference is night and day when, you know, it was these petty smears. Oh, well, Bernie supporters are Bernie bros. And, you know, this sexist attack. Like to see real policy substance, it makes my, you know, nerd heart just feel so warm. I love it.
It is wonderful. And, you know, both of those student debt cancellation plans are better than Harris's, which, you know, I can't even remember all the stipulations you have to hit in order to actually qualify for her partial student. It's insane. And that's why, yeah. You know, I mean, Harris, Booker, Beto O'Rourke, to me, the most, I don't want to say most spectacular, but probably the weirdest thing is how spectacularly those three have just almost disappeared. And I know Harris is still in fourth place, but that's a distant fourth, you know, virtually tied with, you know, Buttigieg, who 6 months ago, nobody in this country knew who he was. And for her to be, you know, that low, almost about to be passed by Buttigieg, that to me is remarkable. These hardcore establishment folks just absolutely falling off the radar. And I think that is a good sign as we get closer to Iowa here.
Yeah, I agree with that because it demonstrates to me that we were correct when we said that voters care about policy and they just cannot compete with the policies that are being put out by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And they, you know, they know what is and isn't going to get them, you know, the support of the Democratic Party electorate. We've kind of seen this with Kamala Harris, where she was seemingly a strong proponent of Medicare for All at the start of her campaign. And now she's essentially backed off. And now she's in favor of a type of pseudo glorified public option. I don't even know what it is because, you know, she thought that she would be able to get the praise that Bernie Sanders gets, for example, by supporting Medicare for All, but also, you know, kind of mute her biggest critics and saying, oh, well, you want to eliminate private insurance. So she thought that she could have her cake and eat it too, but people are married to the details and she's not talking to people. Like, people don't care about their private health insurance. So she thought that proposing a Medicare for All plus private would help her. It actually showed people that she is a flip-flopper. So when people are this, you know, attentive to the very specific policy details, it really is heartwarming to see that because, you know, I knew that people cared about the policies, but to know that they're this, you know, worried about the details and concerned with the very specifics about the role of private and public, you know, insurance, just for that one example, it's great to see. You know, it shows that, you know, people know who is and isn't the real deal. And I really like that. You know, another thing is I still believe that we are in this anti-establishment mindset. People realize that the status quo, anyone who is promoting this idea that we need to keep the current, you know, neoliberal establishment in place, they're just not going to get that much steam because I think that Democratic Party primary voters, they know more than Republican Party primary voters. So Donald Trump, he could easily say, I'm a populist. I care about the little guy, and nobody really looks deeper than just his rhetoric. But, you know, on the left, we kind of had this pseudo-populist in Barack Obama. And so now we've been burned. You know, he was more of a centrist. And now we realize, okay, we have to look at the very specific policy details as well as the campaign contributions that we're taking. So there's all of these things that we're looking out for. And you see that people, they care about the policies. And since people can't compete with Bernie Sanders and even Elizabeth Warren, we're seeing them slowly but surely decline in the polls. And you see the attempts by mainstream media to prop up these candidates, you know, the glowing Chris Cillizza pieces of Pete Buttigieg. But it's not helping, because you can just tell, you know, that they aren't willing to change the system to the extent that Bernie wants to.
And that's what has to happen. That is the only thing that's going to fix what is wrong with this country today, is broad, systemic, structural change. Anything short of that, it's not going to do what we need it to. Mike Figueredo, host of The Humanist Report, amazing show, amazing guest. Thank you very much for talking with us today. We definitely got to do this more frequently.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Farron. It's been a blast.
And that's it for today's Ring of Fire. I want to thank all of our amazing guests, and I want to thank Sam Seder for letting me sit in for him for these last 2 weeks, and he will be returning next week to host the show. And thank you also to all of our podcast subscribers. And don't forget, for even more Ring of Fire, subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. I'm Farron Cousins, and this has been Ring of Fire.